that we serve.
Well, if you have your Bibles, I'm going to ask you to turn with me to the book of Ecclesiastes. The book of Ecclesiastes. It's one of those books that you may not be that familiar with, and so if you're not exactly sure where it is located, if you'll just open your Bible to the middle, you should come or be pretty close to Psalms, over one to Proverbs, over one more to Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes chapter 1. And as you're turning there, let me just point out a couple things for you in the bulletin before we get started. One, I just want to say a little something about the Thanksgiving service that we are planning in a couple of weeks. We want this to be a really special time in the life of our church family. And so I encourage you to, maybe you don't generally stay around for the fellowship meals, let me encourage you to stay around for this meal on this day. We will have communion that morning. The service will be around. The sermon will be around our need for gratitude and thanking the Lord. We'll have followed by Sunday school, and then we'll have our time of fellowship meal where we'll use that time to thank the Lord for what he's done in our life and give everyone an opportunity to share how the Lord is working in their life. So let me really encourage you to be a part of that. We hope it will be a really special time in the life of our church family. And since you'll be having turkey like 4 days later, we'll have chili on that day. And so there's a sign-up sheet on the back table of some items that you could bring if you're going to participate in that. So let me just encourage you to plan on being a part of that. The other thing that I wanted to point out to you there in the bulletins is, as you see at the very bottom there in the middle, next Sunday's sermon. I want you to focus this morning on today, but also I'm going to start doing that as the Lord allows and directs, so that you can, during the week, begin to go ahead and meditate on that passage. Give you some time to look ahead, see what the Lord is saying there, so that you will have it already fresh in your mind as you come the next Lord's Day to hear. And so it also kind of keep me on track as well. And so I encourage you to take advantage of that. But this morning we will begin our study in the book of Ecclesiastes. What is it that you live for? What is it that consumes your thoughts, your energy, your resources, that you look forward to, that you put all of your hope in and you hope to find satisfaction in? What is it that you say, you know, if this would just happen, then I'll be satisfied? This is what I need to find satisfaction in life. Or if this day comes or this event comes, I'll be finally satisfied when that arrives. It was Meriwether Lewis, the great American explorer, and one of the leaders of the Lewis and Clark expedition that explored the western part of the United States in the early 18th century. He said on his 31st birthday, quote, "This day I completed my 31st year. I reflected that I had done as yet but little, very little indeed, to further the happiness of the human race, or to advance the information of the succeeding generation. I viewed with regret the many hours I have spent in indolence, and now sorely feel the want of that information which those hours would have given me had they been judiciously expended." Lewis felt that he had wasted so many hours of his life on himself. And so he resolves on his 31st birthday, he says, quote, "In the future, I resolve to live for mankind as I have heretofore lived for myself." Satisfaction for Lewis, he thought, was to give himself for the advancement of humankind. I will be fully satisfied if for some way and somehow I'm able to advance the cause of mankind, and I will live my life for mankind. So let me ask, like Lewis, what is it that you have given yourself to living for? Maybe knowingly or unknowingly. And for some, maybe you live for retirement. You are living your life here now, working and saving and investing, planning so that one day you can do what you want and you can go where you want with the freedom that you think you'll have, that you think will bring you the satisfaction that you're longing for. And for others, maybe you live for your family. You live to take care of their needs, their wants. You live to make them happy and to give them, to the best of your ability, whatever it is that you can give them. And so you find pleasure and satisfaction in knowing that you have taken care of your family. Maybe you, like many in our country and in our world, live for wealth and possessions. Never really truly satisfied with what the Lord has given you, and you're always looking for the next dollar, you're always looking for the next possession, you're always looking for the next thing that you think will bring you satisfaction. In reality, the amount of things that we can give ourselves over to and to live for and to take pleasure in and to find satisfaction in is extremely vast, summed up here by Solomon as everything under the sun. He says in verse 3, "What does a man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun?" Mankind finds himself or herself giving all their time and their devotion to things under the sun, laboring exhaustively to be satisfied or with the hope of being satisfied in such things. We live for academic accolades. We live for athletic achievements. We live for our work. We live for family and friends. Some live for fun, fame, and fortune. Some live for sex and independence, seeking to be free from all forms of morality and authority. And once they gain that supposed freedom, then they feel like, now I truly can be free to do what I want. And that's part of the reason there's such a push for those things to be accepted in our society, so that they can finally have the satisfaction that they think their hearts long for. And for some of you, you live for special times of the year or special occasions in your life. Maybe you guys live for hunting season. Maybe you live for football season. If you're from Arkansas, you look forward to the end of football season because you can really truly be satisfied when the season is finally over. And that's what you live for. And we live for certain holidays. We live for special occasions like weddings and the birth of children or grandchildren. For some of us, we just simply live for life. We live for the weekend, really aimlessly, not knowing exactly what we're here for, what we're doing. We're just seeking to please ourselves, getting through each work week so that you can have a little fun and relaxation, doing what you want before you have to do it all over again. And that's the life you live. Sadly, for some, there's some that feel as if they don't have anything to live for, nothing to give themselves to. They live each day just wishing you had something or someone to live for, someone or something to give your attention to, your time to, something to break up the monotony of another drudgery day or week or month or year, where you finally think, this is what brings me satisfaction. This is the pursuit that mankind finds himself in, attempting to make life worth living through self-pleasure and satisfaction and with anything and everything under the sun apart from God. A pursuit here that Solomon tells us is weary and futile. A pursuit that Solomon will tell us will never bring us the true pleasure and the true satisfaction that we are longing for and that we think that it will bring us. Sadly, some pursue satisfaction apart from God until their death, never realizing until it's too late that it was all in vain. This morning, we're going to begin looking at the book of Ecclesiastes. And this book of Ecclesiastes reminds us or examines the vain attempts of Solomon to gain personal satisfaction in life. And we'll see that he attempted to do that through devoting himself to wealth, knowledge, pleasure, accomplishments, power, and as he says here, really everything under the sun. He sought to be satisfied and pleased. Ecclesiastes, in many ways, is the painful autobiography of Solomon, who, for much of his life, squandered the blessings of God on his own self-pleasure and his own gratification and pursuits rather than God's glory. And it's a warning to those of us who will hear and to believe to not make the same tragic error that he made, to not follow in the footsteps that he did. He expresses to us his futile attempt, the same attempt that so many make of trying to be satisfied in this life apart from God, even while maintaining his faith in God. We'll see Solomon never said he didn't believe in God. He never didn't trust in God. He just wanted to be satisfied apart from God. And we'll see that as we work our way through the book. We'll see that he warns us that all earthly goals and ambitions, when pursued as ends in themselves, only produce emptiness, leaving us unsatisfied and eventually just craving for more, looking for that one thing that will bring us the satisfaction and the meaning in life that we think that we are longing for. He begins here in chapter 1 by stating that his pursuit for pleasure and satisfaction apart from God has left him seeing life as empty and meaningless and weary. Starting at verse 1, he writes, "The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem, vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities. All is vanity. What does a man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun?" Solomon's view on life is here is more than him just having a bad day. This is not just like, well, you know, things just didn't work out, and so I'm just going to rant today. His pursuit of trying to be satisfied in this life apart from God has led him to two conclusions. The first conclusion, it appears, that all that is done in this life is meaningless, empty, and wearisome. That's the whole point of what he says in verse 2. That's the idea here behind this phrase, the vanity of vanities. The word vanity has a broad range of meaning depending on its context. But here it has the idea of being futile, fleeting, empty, wearisome, absurd, and meaningless. Like a vapor or breath that has no value, it's here 1 second and gone the next. Solomon has concluded that all that he has devoted himself to and all that he's taken pleasure in was vanity. It was empty. It was meaningless. It was fleeting, leaving him weary from all his own vain pursuits. And not just vanity or empty or meaningless. He's not just saying, well, it was just kind of empty or it was just kind of meaningless. This was utter vanity. Complete meaningless. It was completely empty and completely vain. And all that Solomon had tried to find satisfaction in had been short-lived and ultimately had no satisfaction whatsoever and never promised him what he thought it would provide. You know, it may have been satisfying and pleasurable for a time, but that didn't last. That satisfaction and that pleasure didn't sustain. As quickly as the pleasure came, as quickly as the satisfaction came, it disappeared, leaving him weary and seeking to be satisfied in something else only to be disappointed again and again. That's life, trying to find satisfaction in something only to be disappointed again. And this is why he concludes that all is vanity. It's all vanity. I've tried to pursue satisfaction in everything, and it's all left me empty. It's all been wearisome. Nothing in this life could bring him the lasting pleasure and the lasting satisfaction that he was longing for. And therefore, those things were meaningless to him. And consequently, left life, he said, is meaningless. Because these things are not what they promise to be. All these things that we give ourselves to, they are not what they promise to be. It is all vanity. It is all empty. It is all meaningless. It is all wearisome. All that he pursued, all that he invested his time and energy in, all that he looked forward to had left him empty and tired. And to some degree, he was deceived because the very things that he looked for to bring him satisfaction in, the very things that he thought would promise all the things that man needs and the satisfaction that man wants, left him empty, never promising, never providing what they promised. Friend, this is how life is in a fallen world, appearing to promise one thing, only to deliver something else, always leaving us empty and weary after pursuing it apart from God. Some of these things, as we'll see, weren't necessarily wrong in and of themselves, but they were wrong because he looked for satisfaction in those things apart from the Lord. Retirement is not wrong. Family is not wrong. Special occasions are not wrong. But when we're looking to be satisfied in those things apart from the Lord, that's when the issue takes place. And you'll find yourself living a meaningless and empty life. So friend, do you, like Solomon, find yourself seeing much of life that way? devoting your time and energy to something, hoping and thinking that it will bring you the satisfaction and the pleasure you've been longing for, only to be disappointed time and again and again and again. This was the quest that Solomon was on. And this quest for pleasure and satisfaction left Solomon so disappointed with life and the emptiness and the weariness that it had brought him that it led him to the second conclusion. That it appears that when one gains nothing from all or his or her endeavors, it appears that one gains nothing from all of his or her endeavors under the sun. What he says in verse 3. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? This is really the most logical conclusion we are left with. When we view everything as Solomon did here, as empty and futile and wearisome, not bringing the satisfaction and the pleasure we're longing for, then all that we've labored for in trying to pursue those things, he says, was just vanity. It didn't get me anything. I gained nothing from it. All that we give ourselves to here, he says, gains us nothing. I think we find ourselves in that very situation a lot of times, asking that question in our own lives. Why do I do this? No one cares. No one seems to matter. Doesn't seem that anything's changing. Why do I continue to devote so much time and energy to something? Nothing ever seems to change by all this effort, and things continue to be the same. I'm never completely satisfied, and my enjoyment in it, if there is any, never lasts. We're not much different than Solomon. You know, having this attitude reveals a lot about what's going on in our own hearts, their own struggles, their own where we're looking for satisfaction at. We have to ask ourselves, are we seeking satisfaction in pleasure in these things apart from God? Or are we seeing that all that we do in this life as an opportunity to serve Him for His glory and for His honor? And Solomon labored hard. And he labored hard for pleasure, he labored hard for satisfaction, and the things under the sun apart from God, leading him to view all of life and all that is in life as completely meaningless and exhausting. It's a foolish pursuit, because he never gained what he was hoping to gain from all his endeavors. And that's the conclusion that Solomon comes to. And the conclusion that we must guard against in our own hearts and minds, seeing life and what we do in this life as a means to gratify ourselves rather than opportunities for us to do all things for the glory of God. We're not living here for ourselves, friend. We are living here to bring Him glory in all that we do. If you live your life for yourself and your own self-pleasure and gratification, that will eventually lead you to conclude that all that you've done in this life is meaningless and empty. While the other, doing all things for the glory of God, will reward you not only in this life, but friend, it will also reward you in the life to come. We see this truth communicated to us by Christ. As Christ communicated it to his disciples in the passage that Tim read to us this morning in Matthew 16, verse 26. And Christ says, "For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul?" Do you think he had Solomon in mind when he said that? And friend, if you're here this morning, you've never turned from your sins and turned to Christ in faith, hear the words of Christ. Even if you gain the whole world and everything that it offers you, it will come at the cost of your soul. Your only hope is to give up your life, as Christ said, for Him. Now, one's left to wonder, how could Solomon? We know, most of us, I would assume, know Solomon's background, and Solomon's history, Solomon's life. And you think, how could someone with so much wisdom and so many blessings of God come to this conclusion? Where he seemed that life seemed to be meaningless and wearisome to him, and nothing seemed to be gained from all his toil under the sun. How could a guy come to such a conclusion with so many blessings of God handed to him? Well, it's important that we see what led him to this conclusion so that we don't follow those same footsteps. And we'll see that here in this, the remaining part of the chapter, in verses from verses 4 through 11. He really tells us why he came to this conclusion that life is meaningless. It's all vanity, and you don't gain anything by all the work that you do here on the earth. For Solomon, the apparent meaninglessness of life was seen by him in three specific areas. The first one, it was seen in nature's futility. Secondly, it was seen in man's frame. And third, it was seen in history's forgetfulness. Now, before we look at each of these, it's important that I remind you so that we're not confused as you read through the book of Ecclesiastes, what's going on here, because it is a very difficult book to understand. It is a very hard to get your mind around what is Solomon saying. Is this truly indeed inspired text? Because it sounds so different. It sounds so odd that God would say something to this nature. Let me remind you that this section of Scripture here, verses 1 through 11 especially, was not Solomon's conclusion at the end of life. Now, we think he was probably writing at the end of his life, but here he is recalling what his views were as he was going through this endeavor to find satisfaction apart from God. This was his conclusion to life as he failed to be satisfied in the pursuits that he gave himself over to. He is recalling for us his own view of life as he pursued his own pleasures apart from God. It's important that we understand that as we carry on. And here we'll see in verses 4 through 11, or 3 through 11, he's seeking to prove what he's just said. He's seeking to prove why all is vanity. And he's seeking to prove that why he thinks man gains nothing by all his toil. In essence, he's saying, let me just show you why all is vanity. Let me show you why we gain nothing under the sun. And he says there, the apparent meaninglessness of life can first be seen in nature's futility. Starting in verse 4, he writes, a generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes around to the north. Around and around goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they will flow again. All things are full of weariness. He begins his argument here that life is meaningless and wearisome, and all man's labors under the sun accomplish nothing, by arguing first that man's endeavors have no effect upon the earth. Man's endeavors have no effect upon the earth. Really, he is saying here in verses 4 through 7 that the earth really is indifferent to us being on it. It doesn't care that we're on it. It isn't being changed by us dwelling here. We're here before it came. It's here before we came, and it'll be here after we're gone, he argues. He says here in verse 4 that one generation is replaced by another. One generation comes, people are born, people die, but yet nothing changes. You think that all is not vanity? Look, one generation comes, another one goes, but nothing's changed. The earth remains forever. As far as you can see, the earth is still here, he says. Even though there are changes upon the earth, in reality, he says, nothing changes. Nothing changes. Sun still rises, the wind still blows, and the sea is never full. He says here, our human toil, it doesn't affect anything. It doesn't change anything. The earth remains unmoved and uncaring about what we do on the earth. That's his argument. He argues, secondly, that the earth, like man on the earth, appears trapped in a cycle of meaningless, monotonous, and wearisome motion. That's really what he gets at from verses 5 through 7 here. In verse 5, he describes the sun as being on this monotonous cycle where it rises and sets and races back to where it will simply do the same thing again and again and again. It's interesting what he says here about the sun, his view on what the sun does. He describes it as hastening back to its place. What a really sad portrait of the sun, of God's creation. He says the sun rises and the sun sets and it pants, literally is what he's saying. It pants all the way back to where it can do the same thing again the next day and pants again the next day. The ancient Near Eastern concept of the sun was that it would rise, it would travel across the sky, and then it would dart across the bottom of the earth until it could get back to its place the next day to do it all over again. This is what Solomon is describing. The sun is being on a cycle of this breathless, treadmill-like repetition. It toils, it rises, it races across the sky, only to reach its destination, but yet there's no closure. There's no satisfaction. There's no rest. Instead, it must rush back, pant back, all the way back, so it simply could do it all over again the next day. And friend, if we're not careful, we'll see our labors on earth just like that, in a similar fashion. Routine, monotonous repetition, where we achieve no rest, no closure, no satisfaction, finishing one day only to have to rush back and do the very same thing again the next day. Whether that's at your job, or in your home with your family, or friend, even in your service to Christ, you see it as nothing but just a simple thing. It's what you do all the time. Doing the same thing day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year. This was Solomon's argument. You want to prove to me that all is not vanity? You want to prove to me that life is worth gaining, that we actually gain something? Look, we don't change anything. Even the sun is in this rutless cycle that it just continues to do the very same thing over and over and over again. He moves from the sun to the wind in verse 6. And while the sun appears trapped in this continuous cycle, here Solomon describes the wind as really having a facade of being free. As it travels around and around, it seems to have some liberty. It can have some choices. It can do what it wants. It can go where it will. But that apparent freedom is misleading and only serves to point to its monotony and purposelessness on the earth. Because it travels around and around with this supposed freedom, but eventually returns back to where it started. And while it appears to be free, in reality, he's saying it's not free. It's kind of a fatalistic approach to life. We're all just here, just doing the very things that we do. Nothing's out of our, it's all out of our control. We're on this predetermined path, gaining nothing. That's what he says of the wind. And while it puts forth a lot of effort, right, going round and round, going here and going there, he says that effort never allows it to change its course. It's on this kind of rut. And we can often be the same way, going around and around, trying to change something, only to never see our efforts pay off. And like Solomon, we conclude that all our toil gains us nothing. He moves from the sun and the wind to verse 7, to the seas. And here Solomon describes the futile activity of the streams seeking to fill the seas. He says, verse 7, all streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they will flow again. Now it's important that we realize Solomon is not describing the streams as being in this monotonous cycle as the sun was or is, where they kind of flow in and flow out and simply flow in again. That's not what he is describing here. Really, instead, he's describing the activity of the streams being on this futile repetition. It's like painting a wall over its original color, only to have that original color keep coming out, keep shining through the coat. And you put another coat on, and you still see the original color, and you put another coat on, and you still see the original color, and you put another coat on, and you still see the original color. This is how he describes the streams flowing into the sea, just again on top of each other, but yet the seas are never full. It can't be for certain, but many think that Solomon here is referring to the Dead Sea. But because of its level below sea level, it is, and having no outlets, he's saying, look, the streams continually flow into the Dead Sea that has no outlet, but yet the sea is never full. You think your efforts on this earth mean anything? Look, the thing that should fill up doesn't. Now we understand, as I'm sure Solomon did as well, that the real reason that the seas are never full is because of the water evaporation and returning to the clouds and dropping the water again back to the land. But he's saying this here to point out that through all of this work, all of this toil, all of this activity, nothing changes. Nothing is being accomplished. He says, the seas are never full. He said, the streams are caught in this futile repetition that brings no results. In this section of Scripture, Solomon sees the earth really in a scene of massive movement and massive activity, but yet it accomplishes nothing. Nothing ever changes. This activity is nothing but monotonous, meaningless, and wearisome. And that led him to conclude that it's all vanity. We don't gain anything. Look, the world is in this cycle that doesn't ever change. This is why he concludes here, thirdly, in the beginning of verse 8, all things are full of weariness. It's all weariness. A lot of motion, a lot of activity, leading you to think that surely something is going to be accomplished. Surely something is being accomplished. But he says all this activity is for naught, because everything remains the same. The sun still rises, the wind still blows, the streams still flow into the seas, but the seas are never full. A generation goes, a generation comes, and the earth remains forever. Nothing changes, he says. Nothing changes. And his argument is, listen, if the earth gains nothing by all its toil, do you think you're going to gain anything by your toil upon it? Saying you're fooling yourself. And Christian friend, we have to be careful that we don't follow Solomon's example here. That of seeing life from a human standpoint, coupled with human wisdom. And Solomon is seeing these things from a secular mindset, from a humanistic mindset. Instead, we need to view life and what we do in this life from God's perspective, like that of Solomon's father, David. Listen to David's view of the sun as he saw it, being used by God to declare his glory and reveal himself to all of mankind. Compare it to what he says, what Solomon says here. Psalm 19, verses 4 and 5. In them he has set a tent for the sun, which comes out like a bridegroom leaving his chamber, and like a strong man runs its course with joy. Solomon, from a selfish and human perspective, saw the sun as on a monotonous, meaningless, wearisome, repetitious cycle. Whereas David, from a divine perspective, saw the sun as being pure and powerful and joyfully doing what God had designed it to do. Friend, we have to see life and all that we do in it from a divine perspective as well. Or we will, like Solomon, see what we do as being meaningless and wearisome and unimportant. And we'll see our life as nothing but a monotonous repetition of futile activity that really never results in anything. Solomon continues his discourse. He states that the apparent meaningless of life can be seen in man's frame. Number two, the apparent meaningless of life can be seen in man's frame. He continues there in verse 8. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. And Solomon continues his argument that life is meaningless, life is wearisome, and all man's labors under the sun accomplish nothing. He argues that man doesn't understand what he's doing on the earth. How can you have meaning? How can your toil be worth something if man doesn't understand what he's doing on the earth? Nor can man be, is man ever completely satisfied with what he does while he's here. And that's what he's saying here in verse 8. In verses 4 through the beginning of 8a, he's describing the conditions on the earth. The sun rises, the wind blows, the seas are never full. But here in the remainder of verse 8, he's really describing to us how he sees humanity on this monotonous, meaningless earth that we live. And that is, humanity lacks understanding of what they are doing on the earth. And they're never fully satisfied anyways in all that they endeavor to do, all that they seek pleasure in. Again, like earlier, he sees man's existence through the lens of human wisdom and human reason. And the resources of human reason have left humanity facing a blank wall. What are we doing here? What is the purpose of us being here? Never fully understanding the meaning of life First here, he says that at the beginning of verse 8 there, that no one is able to speak to the matter. No one has a sufficient answer. No matter how much Morgan Freeman in his electrifying voice wants to explain away the universe, he can't explain it, he's saying. Humanity, he argues here, is confronted by this seemingly monotonous and aimlessness of life, and no one can speak meaningfully to it or about it. It's all vain, and we don't gain anything because no one can really explain why we're here in the first place. And that is, no one can explain it, no one can influence it, and no one can control it. Life and death still come. The sun still rises, the sun still sets, the wind still blows and blows and blows. The seas are never full. What man does never seems to bring any real changes to the course of life. And he's saying, yet no one, not even the wisest of the wise, can speak to this purposeless enigma that seems to be on the earth. We're just all living a vain life. He argues that the weariness of things is so mind-boggling that it exceeds human ability to describe it. No man can utter this. No man can rightfully explain why we're here from a human standpoint, despite their best efforts. And even though man cannot utter it, even though man cannot explain it, they sure do try to no end. Because he continues here by stating that mankind is never completely satisfied in this life. The eye never reaches a place where it cannot take in anymore. Man is always looking for something else that will bring him satisfaction, something that he wants and that he thinks will ultimately bring him the pleasure and the joy and the hope that he's longing for. Always looking, always grasping for something else. He says here about the ear, that the ear is never completely satisfied with what it hears. Always listening for the next great thing that they think will satisfy their longings. Solomon argues that life is meaningless. Life is wearisome. We gain nothing because we don't even understand why we're here. And while we're here, we're never satisfied anyways. The ceaseless and meaningless activity of nature, he mentions in verses 4 through 7, he said that's mirrored in the human life. It's no different. Activity in nature gains nothing, and activity in human life gains nothing either. How can life, he argues, have meaning and our labor gains something when man doesn't even understand why he's here? And he's never satisfied while he's here. Does that person that Solomon describes sound familiar to you? You find yourself wondering, why am I here? Why am I doing what I'm doing? Why did it fall this way? Why didn't I get that job? Why didn't this happen? Why didn't life be better to me? And you find yourself always looking and listening for something else. Oh, that sounds like that would make me happy. Well, if I got my hands on that, then that would be great. You know, if I did win the Publisher's Clearinghouse, man, that would be it. That's what I long for. Always looking for something and listening for something else to bring us pleasure and satisfaction because we've been disappointed. Why do we look? Because we are continually disappointed with what we've grasped at in the first time. Listen, friend, looking to the world for answers to these questions, as Solomon did, will only lead you on an endless and meaningless pursuit. It is only the giver of life who has the sufficient answers to such questions. It is Christ who says, I have come. I have come that you might have life. And not just any life, but I have come that you might have it abundantly. Solomon saw life as meaningless and wearisome because man doesn't understand his existence, is never completely satisfied in life. So he argues nature's futility. He argues man's frame. And Solomon's final argument here, that life is meaningless and wearisome, gaining nothing, he argues, can be seen in history's forgetfulness. Number 3, it can be seen in history's forgetfulness. Starting in verse 9. What has been is what will be, and what has been is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? It has been already in the ages before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after. Solomon concludes his argument that all is vanity, all is wearisome. Man gains nothing under the sun by all his or her toil, by claiming that nothing is really new, and nobody ever gains the eternal fame that they are longing for. Now, he's not suggesting here that there won't be new things. I think that sometimes gets kind of misconstrued. He says there's nothing new under the sun. Well, that seems kind of odd. Why? He must not know what he's talking about. Of course there's new things under the sun. He's not suggesting that there won't be new things invented through technological advances, but that in reality, new things are nothing more than a variation of something that's already been. He's arguing, there's nothing really new. Just a variation of something that's already been, something that man has already looked forward to try to bring them satisfaction. The Kindle has replaced the book, that has replaced the scroll, that has replaced the first tablet, the stone tablet, right? The car replaces the horse and the camel, bullets replace spears, missiles replace cannons, the television replaces the theater of old. And telephones are just a better means of communication between multiple people, but that communication has always been around. Man never brings about anything that is really new, he argues. So why, if we don't really bring anything that's new, then all our labor has got to be in vain. We're not doing anything, we're not accomplishing anything. Nor is Solomon suggesting here that we won't remember the names of famous people, because we do. Nor is he saying that we won't remember what they've done, because we do. But he's just reminding us that a generation will come that won't remember. They will forget. And despite Meriwether Lewis's endeavor to live his life for mankind, most of us probably can't recall what he did. We don't remember what he's done. And just like we don't remember things done in the past, a generation will come that won't remember what we've done either. People have monuments named after them, only to have a following generation change their name. People have their names and accomplishments chiseled on buildings and statues. But in time, those buildings will deteriorate and be torn down and replaced with new ones. As we've seen in our own country over the last year or so, statues will be torn down by people who don't like them, only to be replaced by ones they do. And Solomon's point is, listen, that people live their lives seeking to be remembered, only to be forgotten by future generations who are seeking to do the very same thing they were, to earn fame for themselves. And he's saying no matter what one does or accomplishes, death is going to come to them. And when death comes, all hopes perish. And no one is better off than another, because no one escapes death. And if death comes to all those, then isn't it all just vanity? Isn't it all just meaningless? No one earns the eternal fame that they're longing for. If what we do doesn't bring any real change to the course of life, and what we will do eventually will be forgotten in the future anyways, isn't it all just meaningless, he says. It's all just vain. Friend, if you're looking to be satisfied by making a name for yourself in this life, you will be disappointed. And don't be fooled. The day after your death, the world will continue on. And we all go to the grave and join the multitudes that before us, soon to be forgotten by those who come after us. And Solomon saw life as meaningless and wearisome, that man gains nothing from all his or her toil under the sun. That was his conclusion. This is all vanity. This is all wearisome. This is all pointless. So the question we have to ask, is it as it seems? Is it as it seems? Is life meaningless and wearisome as Solomon describes it? And do we really gain nothing by all the toil that we toil under the sun? Is it as it seems? Well, the answer is sort of. Sort of. You might not have been expecting that. Sort of. In a way, Solomon is right. And no matter what we do, a generation goes and a generation comes. The sun will still rise, the sun will still set, the wind will still blow on its circuits, the streams will still flow into the seas, and the sea will not be full. In a way, no matter what we do, man will still try to figure out something in life to try to explain why they're here and what their purpose is. Man will never be fully satisfied. No matter what we do, it's really nothing different than what someone has done before us. And in a time, what we do, even the good, we will be forgotten, just as they have. Friend, if we live our lives like Solomon did, seeking self-pleasure and satisfaction apart from God, life will seem meaningless. Life will seem weary. Maybe not now. You may say, life is great, I'm living it up. But there will come a time, hopefully a time before it's too late, where you realize all your endeavors for self-pleasure and gratification were vain. We will be weary if we try to live our life and try to be satisfied apart from Him, and we will feel as if our labors are in vain. So in a way, Solomon is right to a degree. So how do we avoid that? How do we avoid our life being meaningless and weary? Well, thankfully, Solomon addresses that as well. Flip to the end of the book, chapter 12, all the way to the end. We have here what Paul Harvey would call the rest of the story. Chapter 12, starting in verse 13, listen to what Solomon says now, much different. He says the end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. For Solomon in chapter 1, verses 1 through 11, he recalls for us his pursuit of pleasure and his pursuit of satisfaction apart from God, leaving him to view life as meaningless and gaining nothing. But here, after having explored all those things, after endeavoring to find satisfaction, here he says he understands that man's purpose on the earth, despite the difficulties he faces, despite the questions he cannot always answer, he's to fear God. He's to keep His commandments. That's the end of all matters. That's really what the issue is. He concludes that life can have meaning and our labors can have value. Why? Because it is God, verse 14, who assesses and brings every judgment upon every deed we do, whether good or bad. If they're important to God, that He will assess them, then friend, they are important. And while this thought that everything that we do, that God assesses all that we do and all that you and I do and will bring judgment upon every deed that you and I do, is a serious and sober concept. I hope you take it seriously. I hope you take it very soberly, that this is, whoa, God evaluates everything that I do. Yes, He evaluates everything that you do. Even though you may think it is meaningless, God sees it as an opportunity for you to bring Him glory. He evaluates everything that you do. While it is a serious and sobering thought, Solomon intends those words to be a delight to you. A delight to you. Look what he says in verse 10. The preacher sought to find words of delight, and uprightly he wrote words of truth. The words of the wise are like goads, and the nails firmly fixed are the collected sayings. He's saying to us, be delighted in that. Be delighted that God is assessing everything that you do. Man may not see your efforts. Man may not care about your efforts. Man may not like your efforts. And man will soon forget what you've done anyways. But he's saying, God sees, and God cares, and God will not forget anything that you have done. He's saying, like goads driving the sheep, he's saying, let the words here in verse 14 drive you to do what he says in verse 13. The fact that God is assessing everything that I do in this life, I need to fear Him and keep His commandments. Let those drive you to doing what you should do. In reality, these aren't Solomon's words. What he says there at the end of verse 11. These words that I have communicated to you, these words of delight, they've been given to me by the shepherd, by the one shepherd. The great shepherd of his sheep wants us to know that our life is not meaningless to him. And our life can have great, our labors can have great value when we fear him and keep his commandments. If we live this life seeking for self-pleasure and satisfaction apart from God, eventually all will seem as vanity. And our labors will seem to be in vain because they are in vain because we use them for our own self-pleasure and gratification. It is only when we live this life fearing God and keeping his commandments that our labors will have any lasting value. You think, well, this was Old Testament. This was Solomon. Has that really been conveyed in the New Testament? Listen to what Paul tells the Corinthian church, and then we'll close. In 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 58, he tells them, "Therefore, my beloved brothers, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that in the Lord your labor is not in vain." Oh, friend, our life is meaningful to him. As we read this morning, our life is but a breath. Our days are but a passing shadow. But God looks down on man and says, "I am watching what you do with it." Don't labor in vain. Labor for Christ. Let's pray.